Hi, I'm Mac.
Hi, I'm Abigail.
And this is Unsubs. This is the podcast where we recap, rate, and review all 324 episodes of Criminal Minds. And today we're doing season 3, episode 15, A Higher Power. Also, we should mention that this is a serious trigger warning for suicide and sexual abuse. And we will link resources for you in the notes. And if those are triggers for you, then you should definitely skip this episode.
Yeah.
Do you have a fun fact?
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh, I do.
Yes. Okay.
I performed in Rocky Horror last week.
Oh my god, I forgot about that. How did that go?
It was really fun. It was really, really fun. There aren't a whole lot of Rocky Horror shadow casts around where I live, which is surprising because I live in a very culturally and artistically diverse and rich area. Money rich, yes, but because there's really well-funded theaters around here and stuff, but for some reason there I've never gone to see Rocky Horror shadow cast before, just because there weren't any that weren't substantially far away. So this was the first one for a lot of people. A lot of the audience were virgins, and pretty much most of the cast had never been in a shadow cast before either, which was so fun, and it was a great experience. But part of that meant that the audience participation parts were didn't really have a great gauge for that. So I don't know how familiar you are with a shadow cast for Rocky Horror. You're lip syncing it in front of the audience. The movie's playing and you're lip syncing everything and doing the same physical movements in time with the movie. But there's a lot of call outs that the audience does where they call, Janet a slut and Brad an asshole every time that they show up. And you're supposed to say things, but you're also supposed to do things. One of the things that you do at the beginning is when the movie opens and they're at the wedding, you throw rice on to the actors. The theater had created little, they're called survival packs for the audience to have, which is the rice and the squirt gun and other props, playing cards to throw. And Frankenfurter says cards for sorrow, cards for pain. And stuff like that. And, they gave them a little baggie of rice. And it was a tiny amount that you could just have in your hand to toss. And it wouldn't cause an issue. But someone must have gone to Whole Foods and where they have those big plastic disposal things to pour. It felt like someone had fully emptied a Whole Foods thing of that, because they threw the rice and it just didn't stop. It kept coming and kept coming, and it was packed onto the stage, and I'm looking at my Brad and I'm oh fucking no, we're supposed to sing and dance, damn it, Janet, and I'm wearing heels and the floor, the stage is just covered.
Oh my god.
And so one of our the girl who is playing our criminologist and narrator just runs on and goes, "Sorry, Brad and Janet," with a huge broom sort of thing, and pulls it off stage so that we can safely navigate the area.
Wow.
But also it was we had stairs going into the audience and stuff, so it was a little precarious. And then, sorry, this is such a long fun fact, guys, I apologize, but I promise you this might be better than the episode we're about to cover.
Yes, it definitely will be.
And and so the next thing is, after that is, the scene where they, they're in their car in the rain, and it's storming, and the audience is supposed to spray us with squirt guns. I do not fault the theater for this because they didn't want to pre-fill the squirt guns with water and then have them leak into the, like, seats of the theater, because you would go into the audience, find your assigned seat, and there would be, like, a paper bag with all of your props in them. So they didn't want to, like, preload it and have one leak into the bag and then also get the seats wet, but it meant that some people thought it was a good idea to not put water in the squirt gun, but to put alcohol. So I was fully sprayed with white wine and red wine, and it fully stained my costume. So that was super shitty.
Oh my god, it stained your costume?
Yeah, they had to fully throw away the white sweater I was wearing because they're like, well, that's not going to come out.
Shit. Yeah. That's, I mean, awful.
It didn't tarnish the experience. It was still really fun and it was a great experience, and I really hope to do it again because only doing one performance felt like such a tease. But yeah, hopefully that won't happen next time, if there is a next time.
My fun fact is that I bought merch from Obsessed with Disappeared, and it took like 2 months to come. But I bought these like joggers that are like these gray cozy fleece lined joggers that say Down Bitch University. So they're always talking about down bitches on their show, and I'm obsessed with them. Shout out. That's my fun fact. Okay, so now I should tell you that we are in no way, shape, or form associated with Criminal Minds. We sure would like to be.
All right, and our rating criteria, as always, is out of 100 points within these 5 categories: criminal/serial killer, character development/character arcs, forensics and context, script writing, and background characters.
All right, should I get into it?
Let's get into it. This is such a bad episode.
And again, trigger warning for suicide and abuse and child abuse specifically. So we open in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where my friend Danielle is from. Shout out, Danielle. It's storming outside. A woman enters a house talking on the phone. She's making casual conversation, but mentions that, quote, it would have been Amy's birthday tomorrow. When she says this, she picks up a picture of a young girl, and we can only assume that the girl is Amy. And by the past tense that the woman's using, that Amy is no longer with us. Oh, God. Trigger warning also for children death. Just trigger warning for everything in this episode. I'm sorry, guys. So the woman mentions that her husband, Paul, has been such a rock. And after she says that, the house loses power, and you think probably because of the storm. So she hangs up the phone and she hurries upstairs looking for Paul, only to find his body in the bathtub. It's one of those things where the door is locked and the water's running and it's seeping out into the hallway, and she busts down the door and Paul is laying in the tub holding a toaster. And it looks as if he's committed suicide.
And that's what would have blown the power.
Yes, yes. Not the storm. Cut to BAU headquarters in Quantico, Virginia. The BAU is called in to investigate the case by Detective Ronnie Bailman from Pittsburgh PD. Apparently, the toaster bathtub suicide is not an isolated incident. JJ briefs the team, and we learned that 3 months ago, a fire at a Pittsburgh rec center killed 14 children. 14 children.
Oh my God.
Over the past 3 months after the fire, there have been 5 suicides. And of these 5 suicides, all of them have been parents who lost children in the fire. So Amy, the girl whose picture we saw, she died, and Paul was the dad, and the suicide, and yada yada. we learned that the most recent suicide is Paul Bailman, who is the brother of Ronnie Bailman, who's the detective who asked the BAU to work the case. And Morgan is skeptical, as always. He's always skeptical. He's always like, I don't know. Rossi points out that suicides don't spike after a tragedy, and Reed says, do you want to say this quote, Abby? Because it's kind of a longer one.
Quite the opposite, actually. Following World War I and II, and right after Kennedy was shot, and following 9/11, suicides plummeted. Within a society, external threats typically create group integration.
Come on, next case.
Well, now, wait a second. 5 suicides in the same neighborhood within months? That's a serious spike.
Suicides don't spike after a tragedy.
Quite the opposite, actually. Following World War I and II, right after Kennedy was shot, and following 9/11, suicides plummeted. Within a society, external threats usually create group integrations.
People come together. So if there's reason for doubt, which there obviously is, don't those families left behind have a right to know?
However, Hotch needs a personal day. He tells Rossi that he has to talk to Jack and explain the divorce that he and Haley are going to have. And I think this is great. I often need personal days to talk to my son Jack about my upcoming divorce. So anyway, Rossi's in charge while Daddy Hotch is away. On the plane, Morgan is bitching about the fact that they're taking the case at all. Morgan is like, Hotch never would have taken this case. And Rossi is like, tough shit. Everyone else thinks this is suspicious. So far, there have been 19 deaths related to the fire. And Morgan's like, this is not suspicious at all. The team then discusses how if there is an unsub, he or she is likely an angel of death. And I think this is the 3rd or 4th time we've seen an angel of death on Criminal Minds. Yeah, you did a deep dive on them.
Early on, yeah.
At the Pittsburgh PD, the team meets with Detective Bailman. Reed starts going over the files to build a psychological profile and says, quote, psychological profiles to determine whether the victims killed themselves. Prentice asks to see Paul Bailman, who we know is the latest victim. She asks to see the house, and Brother Detective Ronnie is like, I'll take you. And the entire team is like, no. And I'm like, okay, but like, what about when Garcia was shot? Hotch was like, we're working this case one way or another. It's like, it just drives me crazy because it's like, when the BAU, when like a member of their team is like in jeopardy, they're like, we're working this case. But then like with something like this, where Ronnie Bailman is trying to get involved in this case because his brother died, they're like, oh no, that we have to preserve the sanctity of the case. And I'm just like, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, my friends. Prentice, Rossi, and Morgan visit Paul Bailman's house and they speak to his wife, and she insists that her husband was not depressed and that he would never have killed himself. Morgan and Prentice look over the bathroom while Rossi talks to the wife about the rec center fire. Morgan and Prentice notice that the bathroom outlet is non-GFI, so it's not waterproof or properly grounded, which is super common in older houses, and the Bailman house is older. Actually, my house had that, and when we had our inspection, we were told that we had to have our outlets grounded in GFI, or like it didn't pass safety inspection. So it's super common in older houses, and the ones that were fucked up in our house were on the outside. So it's just like a safety precaution to like make sure water doesn't get in there. Usually, they only really care about them in like the kitchen or the bathroom, or like places where water could get in. The downstairs outlets have been remodeled and grounded, and Morgan is like, I put the GFI outlets on all of my properties. And Prentice is like, what? How many properties? And Morgan is like, 4. And Prentice is like, ... And I'm like, yo, so Morgan's a landlord now? Like, Jesus Christ, can you imagine? Like, what? So, like, they just dropped a dog on us in one episode, and now they're, like, dropping this whole landlord thing on us. I bet you it will never be brought up again. The bottom line is Paul Bailman was a contractor, so he would have known that the bathroom outlet was not grounded and would have failed a safety inspection. So J.J. Reed and brother detective Ronnie Bailman are putting together psychological autopsies. This won't determine whether the victims were murdered, but would determine whether their mental state would cause them to commit suicide. Reed says, quote, "Since its inception in 1958, it's proven to carry a 92% accuracy rate in cases that went to trial." And I'm just like, is this true, though? Because this just kind of seems like bullshit. Like, basically, they just look at, like, writings from the victims, and they're like, this doesn't seem sad based off of graphology, which everyone knows is a sham. And I'm like,
Right.
Detective brother Ronnie Bailman is like fair, like he's 100% convinced that there must be a serial killer going around and making these deaths look like suicides. And the BAU, at least Reed and JJ, seem pretty convinced of it as well.
Basically, they're like, let's do Heathers, but make it bad.
What?
Like killing people and making it look like a suicide.
Oh my God. Oh my God, I cannot believe that that went over my head. I just was so unprepared for you to bring up Christian Slater right now when Heathers is my fucking jam. I love that Heathers. Movie.
Me too.
That is so true. I could have been making Heathers jokes this entire time. So we cut to a woman in a house talking to her toddler, and his name is Jakey. Music is playing It's Road to Shambhala, and the lyrics are, yeah.
Wash away my sorrow, wash away my shame with the rain, Shambhala.
Is the time. Okay, so her name is Beth Smoller, and we must but assume that she also had a child who died in the rec center fire, because otherwise why would we be seeing her? We see Beth let someone into her house, and we know it's a white man. We can only see him from the shoulders down, but it's a white man. And she tells him that his bag is in the other room, and they walk off screen. We then watch Jakey, the best behaved toddler in the world, sit in his high chair for multiple hours, as evidenced by the darkening room. Multiple hours, like quietly, patiently waiting for his mother. To which I say, have you ever met a toddler? Because my friend Danielle, who I've already brought up in this episode once, she has a toddler. And as much as I love her toddler, it takes 1 second for him to be screaming. 1 second. Like, this is the most unrealistic thing about the whole goddamn episode, is that Jakey sits there for multiple hours and does not scream.
He's processing trauma.
How? She doesn't know that
the sibling died.
But the Road to Shambhala is playing. Yeah. I'm gonna cut that shit in. And y'all are gonna be sick and tired of hearing it by the end of this goddamn episode. We're back to Morgan, and he's still skeptical. He's still like, I'm not sure, fam. Like, this could be just people being depressed. And I'm like, Morgan, like, what the fuck? So he and Prentice discuss how they both believe that Paul Bailman's death was a suicide. So again, Paul Bailman is the brother of Ronnie Bailman. This is the guy in the toaster bathtub that we originally saw. They think that his death was definitely a suicide, but they have suspicions about all the other deaths being murders. Oh, yeah. Yeah. OK, case. So the team now believes that the unsub has been drugging the victims using something that doesn't show up in talk screens, but allows the unsub to control the victims and get them to kill themselves? Question mark, question mark, question mark.
Checks out.
It's a little, convoluted. Reed looks at letters from Deidre Nolard. She was one of the other suicide victims. Or, you know, one of, could be suicide, could be murder victims, I should say. He looks at an insurance form, a letter she wrote to a neighbor, a birthday card she wrote to her husband, and her suicide note. He says the suicide note is definitely in her handwriting, but the upward slanting writing and T-bars do not indicate someone who is depressed. And again, I say graphology is a scam. Check out our my deep dive on that. It's on our website if you want to read the whole thing. JJ finally informs the media, and Hotch shows up. So I guess that personal day went well. And it's time for the profile.
So this is an Angel of Mercy. It's going to sound a little familiar because we've had similar things to this. Including extended families, over 100 individuals were impacted by this fire. So a single event in this unsub's life led him to end the life of someone he believes had to die. From that moment, he created his own sense of reality. He rationalizes what he did, like his first kill, over and over again, and by targeting people that he believes can't be saved by anyone but himself. He decides who lives and who dies, and this gives him an all-consuming power. He also won't stop anytime soon, and he's convinced he's on a mission of mercy. Once caught, won't admit that he's done anything wrong. And then again, now we get to some of the really, like, obvious stuff. He's a white male in his late 30s. He's polite, forthcoming, doesn't stand out. His victims are all letting him into their homes, and in every case, there's no evidence of a struggle, no attempts at escape. So he's all about control, chooses how to die, when they die. He's hypervigilant, always on the lookout, and a risk adverse.
Well, I just, while you were reading that, really quick popped on our website, went under our recaps, and pulled up our profile, because all of our recaps are up on our website now, and you can read and scroll to your heart's content. It looks like we're talking about LDSK. I guess they called it a hero homicide complex, but it's very similar. I would say it's the same thing. So they said the motivations are excitement, power, and respect, that the person would be arrogant, conceited, and feel superior to everyone around them. So the BAU talks to the parents of the talks to the families of children who died in the fire, and they are all going through it, and they're very upset that on top of grieving their lost family members, now they also have to worry about this. Garcia runs full toxicological panels on the victims. How does she do this from her room in Quantico, where she does not even, like, see the bodies? She's not even in... Am I crazy? How does she do this?
I have no idea.
Anyway, she said that she did it. I don't believe it. They all came back negative. So Garcia believes the unsub has been drugging the victims with a paralyzing agent that metabolizes quickly. I guess she called up the coroner and was like, what are your thoughts on this, oh medical professional who's actually touching the bodies? How would you do this? And he's like, okay, I would use a needle. And she's like, okay, well, look for needle marks. The coroner found that in the latest victim, Beth's hairline, he found a puncture mark. And Garcia furthermore says that you can buy these kind of drugs online. You don't have to be a medical professional. I also have questions about that. I don't believe that that's true, but I'm going to keep going. Ooh, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Garcia also points out that she believes the UNSUB drugs the client with a muscle relaxant that also paralyzes them, so they can't move, but and I guess they're relaxed, but they're wide awake when the UNSUB kills them, which is the most terrifying thing. Cut to the UNSUB with his latest victim named Curtis Fackler. They're in Curtis's house. We see Curtis, which is also the name of my friend Danielle's husband.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my God. It's almost like she's here with me right now. I have to text her. I've talked about her 3 times now. This is crazy. Shout out Danielle. So anyway, he is, he's sitting in his chair. He's completely drugged and immobilized. And the UNSUB, who is a white male in his late 30s, he shoots Curtis and makes it look like a suicide. The BAU team races to the scene and confirms a puncture mark on the back of Curtis's head. And Curtis has written a suicide note. And Morgan is like, all right, Rossi, I'm in. Reed analyzes all of the suicide letters and determines that based off of the tone of the letters, that they weren't meant to be read as suicide letters. Reed makes the leap that they're letters written for support groups like AA and NA. For those of you who don't know, these groups are for people suffering with addiction or tragedy. You go to them weekly and talk about your troubles. They are anonymous. If you participate in ones like AA and NA, you most likely will start working on the 12 steps of recovery, which are supposed to help you recover from your addiction. And one of the steps is to make amends. There's lots of letter writing and sharing and emotional support and that kind of thing. I have some experience with this sort of thing, and not to be a downer, and I just feel like it's worth being said because it's not said enough. And if you are arrested for DUI, they make you go to these groups. There is no proof that these groups actually work. They work for some people, but their success rate is about 50%. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please see our show notes for more assistance. There are other avenues that you can explore, or you can show someone in your life if they are struggling. Back to the episode. That was my little deep dive right there. After the BAU speaks to different members of these different support groups, they begin to recognize a story being told by a man calling himself Peter. I guess the BAU team is just going around and being like, do you recognize the description of this guy? He would have told a serious story. He would have wanted to share it a lot. But apparently he's been making the rounds in the groups talking about his brother James's suicide. Peter's story goes like this, and serious trigger warning here, this is awful. Their father was a professor at Brossard University, and he would come up to their room at night and molest James. And Peter was right across the room, and Peter would lay there and pretend that he couldn't hear. And then one night, James slashed his wrists, and Peter saw this. Garcia is able to confirm this story using Brossard College's newspaper, which I thought was super interesting. The UNSUB's full name is Peter Redding. BAU and Detective Bailman go to Peter's apartment. They find a murder board with a grid of potential victims categorized by support groups. Peter is very helpful. Where he's been crossing off the victims on his murder board once he kills them. So the BAU determines that the next victim, based off of Peter's murder board, will be Lori Ann Morris. The Morris family is one that the BAU has already talked to warn about the UNSUB. So the BAU calls Lori Ann's husband and determines that she is likely still at her support group. Cut, and we see Lori Ann walking with UNSUB Peter in the parking lot. The BAU shows up at the support group when it's just ended, and they spread out to look for Lori Ann. We cut back to Lori Ann getting into her car. She starts to drive away, and she notices that Peter is having trouble with his car. And we're like, no, girl, don't do it. He's the UNSUB. But she pulls over, and she asks if he has AAA, and he's like, no, it's expired. And Lorianne is like, it's okay, I'll drive you. So Peter gets into the car, but he gets into the back seat, which I'm like, what is she, your chauffeur? And he does not put on his seatbelt. He then immediately, before she can even, like, drive away, he tells Lorianne that he can help her. And, like, because she's already been warned about the BAU, like, she knows, like, almost instantly that, like, he's been the one killing people. And she's like, you think you can help me? And while this is happening, the BAU see Lorianne and Peter in the car and they rush over. And then, like, Peter's still like, I can help you. I know you're in a lot of pain. I can take the pain away. And Lorianne is like, you think you can help me? And then she yeets her car into the side of the building. And Peter the unsub wasn't wearing a seatbelt, so he's fucked up. But Lorianne's fine because she was wearing a seatbelt. Children, wear your seatbelts, okay? So the BAU arrests Peter, who's like, why? I didn't do anything. And Lorianne is fine. And she's like, okay, now I can process my trauma and hold my child, I guess. I don't know. I don't care. This episode sucks. At the end, the BAU tells Detective Brother Bailman, yeah, we solved the case, but your brother did actually kill himself. So we're going to fuck off back to Quantico. Bye! I'm sorry, you guys. I just didn't care about it that much.
Me either.
Oh, God. But there's, you know what? Season 4 is a banger. Season 2 is a banger. Season 1 was a lot of fun. And season 4, it has some absolutely crazy episodes in it. So I'm looking forward to getting through this season.
My deep dive is not that deep. It's a bit more of a shallow dive. And this is one that you suggested I do, which is psychological autopsies.
Because they basically used this to crack the case, even though all they did was look at letters people wrote and analyze T-bars, which sounds a lot more like graphology instead of whatever, but okay.
So I looked up from a couple different sources, and some of them basically say that psychological autopsy is exactly what it sounds like. So it's a psychological profile that determines the mental state of someone who is already deceased. There's a lot of different reasons why you would conduct one, the most common one being to determine the cause or nature of a death. And whether that be natural causes, suicide, homicide, or an accident. So it's kind of what's on the tin. But there are some... it is under some ethical review. I'm quoting from study.academy lesson psychological autopsy definition. So psychological autopsies, they say, are very much an inexact science, and researchers are strongly encouraged to have their methodologies and protocols reviewed prior to beginning an investigation. So in this case, an institutional review board, IRB, can be contracted to review the research materials to ensure that the investigation is conducted ethically and does not violate anyone's rights or personal privacy. Among the things investigators will want to keep in mind is the strong potential for structural bias, which is a type of bias that influences how a person interprets events in light of their beliefs. So, in this case, investigators are looking for accurate information, which is being gathered from a third party, and then because of this, their reporter may potentially give biased information about the person's behavior based on what they think or feel about that individual. So, in order for it to be efficient and effective, it definitely needs to be done by a third party that doesn't have any sort of emotional or personal relationship to the deceased.
It just sounds like not actual science.
Yeah, it to me, I find it strange that it even has like a name. because it sounds like there's no structure to how you do it. Like,
yeah.
And I know that, like, it would be case to case, but it sounds like there isn't necessarily, like, a exact or defined methodology of, like, step one, step two. Again, I'm not in the FBI. I could be totally talking out of my ass. Maybe there is one. But from what I found, I it was just like, it's when you kind of analyze a dead person and figure out why they're dead. Like, there wasn't any sort of explanation of what that process looks like.
It just sounds like, why would you bother with that when you could just look at the evidence of the case and, like, the crime scene and the person's body?
It sounds like an armchair diagnosis wearing a fancy lab coat, so it sounds legit.
All right. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let's rate this baby.
This is going to be such a half-hearted rating because I just don't care about this episode.
I know, and it's shitty because, like, I feel like there is a lot of energy and effort that, like, there's a lot of energy and effort that go into, like, creating each episode and a lot of thought and forethought. And, like, there's definitely someone out there who's like, A Higher Power is my favorite episode of Criminal Minds. And I'm sorry to that person. But there's just, when it sucks because when you see something so good, you're like, everything is below that standard. Like, North Mammon, everything's below that standard. Like, you just can't, you know, like, this just doesn't compare.
Or the Fox.
You know what? In retrospect, don't you agree the Fox should have gotten a higher score? Now that you've done, like, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that could be a fun Patreon thing, too, where, like, once we're a couple seasons in.
Go back and redo it.
Not redo it, but just, like, talk about it and be like, maybe it should have gotten a higher score.
Yeah.
I don't know. In terms of the criminal slash serial killer. Oh, wait. There was one thing. Okay. I do like the twist that they're like, Ronnie Bailman, your brother actually killed himself.
Yeah.
Everyone else was murdered, but your brother. I shouldn't laugh because it's not funny, but, like, let's, like, what
it's
the fuck?
It's a little funny.
Kick him while he's down. And he's like, I don't believe you. Okay. The criminal slash serial killer. I mean, it's a white man in his late 30s who.
With trauma.
I mean, it's not mommy trauma for once.
I gotta give him props for that.
So his brother died and that was traumatic, but then he, like, moved on with his life and, like, did stuff. And then the fire was so traumatic that even though he didn't have anyone die in the fire, he was just so overwhelmed with the grief that then he started killing people.
It doesn't make sense.
Okay. What did you say?
I was going to say 10, but maybe we should give 7.
Yeah, we could give 7.
All right. Character development and character arcs. Was there any?
Hotch took a day off. I barely noticed he was gone because he was like, I'm back.
I straight up didn't notice he was gone.
I don't know. 11 because Hotch took a day off.
Sure. Forensics and context.
Oh, bullshit. There was
5.
5.
Script writing.
I would give it a 5 and only because we learned about GFI outlets.
Yeah. All right. Background characters.
I did like that Laurie Ann was like, you think you can help me? And she yeeted the car into the building that she had just left. I thought that was great. I like that she stopped the serial killer. She would have been fine had the BAU not shown up. She had it handled.
Yeah, so do you want to give it, like, a 7 or an 8?
Okay, let's give it a 10, because I liked Brother Bailman. I liked him.
38.
Well, you know, if any of you have opinions and you think these should be refuted, let us know and maybe we'll consider it.
Sound off in our Instagram comments or DMs, or send us an email at unsipspodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, and check out our website. All the recaps and all of the deep dives are up there.
It's like the raw, bare bones of our episode outlines. So some of it might be a little nonsensical, but it's kind of cool to see how much of this is genuine, authentic improv.
Like, we do a good job. Like, not for nothing. Like, we write them out and we, like, tell us, you know, like, it stands on its own. And also, if someone is hard of hearing or can't hear, like, this is another way for them to engage. And furthermore, no one else out there has done this. Like, no one is writing, like, line for line, scene for scene, what's happening in these episodes. So once our SEO kicks in, people will actually see that we have the full fucking summary. And, you know, like, no one else is that crazy. So, yeah, check us out, unsubpodcast.com. It's in the notes. Buy our merch. Follow us, unsubpodcast, everywhere. You can follow me, yournewapartment.tumblr.com.
Yes, and you can follow me at Between Stage and Screen Podcast on Instagram and all of your favorite streaming services. It'll come back one day, I promise.
Yeah!